You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 5th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
A high-speed tour through Europe's best newsstands, a favourite contributor with a big conference on the horizon, the grand dam of luxury and design journalism, and reports from Miami, Vienna, and the rumbling streets of London. Fasten your chinstrap for edition 58 of The Stack. On today's edition of The Stack, we have a double newspaper bill from Austria and Colombia, where the digital switch isn't as complete as you might think. We speak to the editors who are making some tough decisions at their iconic national dailies. First up, Vienna.
We will have to redefine the philosophy of the print edition in general, and especially as for the weekend edition.
And over to Bogota via Miami.
Many people still think there's nothing more comfortable, at ease, and faster to navigate than newspaper. Other people think this is terrible that they cut down a tree to put a news on paper.
And we'll also be getting our leathers on and meeting a pair of bikers who have an obsession for print and petrol.
And it just kind of felt there's something lacking from the bike press that we were buying and reading, which was kind of real people stories. So the people behind the bikes, whether they kind of, you know, ride them or tweak them or
design them.
All that and much more in this 58th edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brulé. It's been a snappy tour of this region's newsstands over the past week, with a quick jump over to Tel Aviv on Sunday, where I was rather shocked to find that Israel is lacking a well-stocked, well-organized newsstand culture. While Tel Aviv locals clearly know how to run a bountiful juice bar, I couldn't help but think about how nice it would be to convert one of the many fruit kiosks into an equally bountiful newsstand. 24 hours later, it was a stop at the almost complete main station in Geneva and a dash into Relay to buy some French and German titles. And at the other end of the line, a good half hour was spent in Zurich's Hauptbahnhof newsstand, marveling at the array and depth of fine titles on offer. The next day, it was on to Stuttgart, where I was greeted by perhaps the most complete kiosk on the continent. The Presse Center would put pretty much any US or UK newsstand to shame with its dense mix of periodicals covering every passion and pursuit. With new launches front and center by The Till and more obscure independent titles given their own special section, lovers of magazines might want to make a special journey to Deutschland's Motor City to sample the delights. Now, let's meet our guests joining us around the table. And we have Lucia Vanderpost is here. Very good to see you. Lucia, I imagine, we were just chatting before we went on air. It was a summer a little bit here, a little bit in Italy. What was Lucia Vanderpost reading this summer?
Oh, well, I now have just joined a book club. And so I was also judging a small literary award. So I was really rather catching up on things that I was supposed to read. We decided in our book club to read the Ian Banks, as none of us had read any. And I have to say, I thought his latest one, the last one he wrote when he was dying, was really rather disappointing.
Now, was this the first time venturing into a book club or?
I've been in a book club now for about 6 months and have read an array of books that I wouldn't otherwise have read, which was the whole point of joining. James Salter was my great discovery. Don't know if anybody's read James Salter.
Mm-mm.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful writer. And we all read The Museum of Innocence. I don't know if any of you have read that. The Turkish Nobel Prize winner. And that was a great discovery.
And what about sort of jaunts into town when you were in Italy? Anything that caught your eye on the newsstand? I was wondering sort of...
Afraid not. We were really lounging around the pool and eating too much. I'm sorry.
Also joining us around the table today is Jeremy Leslie, of course, a regular voice on this program, creative director, of course, at Mag Culture. And as we've mentioned, book is just out, The Modern Magazine, which we've touched on. Why don't we just dip in again? How's the response been so far? And what's the market saying?
So far, so good. It's
been out for 2 weeks now, almost.
It's been out a couple of weeks. Yeah. I can only measure it from the sales from my website, and that's selling well through there, and it seems to be in the shops. Did a couple of signings. It's been a good response.
Mm. Yeah. But I guess, as just mentioned at the top of the program, you have your conference
yes,
coming up.
Absolutely.
So the focus of it, because obviously it's a crowded conference market, particularly when it comes to media, and so many people, of course, with question marks. We had a report from FIP in Rome, last week, and really looking at the state of what's happening, with the bigger, more massive end of the magazine market, and of course how so many publishers are struggling, what the solutions are. What are you hoping to do with your conference this year?
Well, the main thing for me is to kind of draw a line under the kind of pessimism around the business and look at the upside, which for me is there's so much innovation and creativity coming through. In a sense, the problems the industry faces means that all bets are off and everyone can have a go at doing things that perhaps were considered outre just a few years ago. So I'm looking forward to hearing from a number of magazine makers at the conference who are going to be talking about projects which are challenging the mainstream and challenging the orthodoxy of how things have been done. Mm.
So who's on the lineup? And
we range quite a broad range of people. We've got Richard Turley from Bloomberg Businessweek, the creative director who's been reinventing the news weeklies out in the States, a Brit, but he's returning for that especially.
And is that a bit of an art direction infographics masterclass? Because Bloomberg Businessweek is an interesting story. Formerly owned by McGraw-Hill, and of course taken over by Bloomberg, and went through this massive reinvention and has really become much loved. I mean, for its covers and primarily infographics, but also many people thought, oh, this huge fear about, oh, it's going to be just, it's taken over by what many see as a wire service. But, it's become a much more nimble, journal, week in and week out.
Absolutely. I think Rich is going to be concentrating on the front covers because I think that there's a masterclass to be had there in terms of turning around really creative, different every week covers on in that kind of environment where you're often dealing with quite dry issues and making them interesting. I think he and Josh Tirangil together, the editor, since they reinvented the magazine 2-3 years ago, have shown the way forward for how to make great magazines. Mm. It's a unique partnership. I think there's a tradition, certainly in American publishing, whereby you have huge teams, you have a lovely office. At one end, the editor has the one corner office, and the other end is the art director in his corner office. Mm. They meet occasionally. Josh and Richard sit across each other as close as we are, and they work the magazine. They create the magazine together in a way that shows in every front cover, certainly, but every page and every detail on that page.
Mm. And who else?
So we have... I'll mention some at the other extreme, from the sort of big blockbuster American magazine down to some of the favourite independent titles that we know here. So Rosa from Serial magazine will be speaking, Kathy from Anorak magazine, and of course yourself. Looking forward to hearing,
yes, I'll be there as well.
You joining?
Yes, exactly. And then Apartmento, you've got Omar?
We've got Omar from...
Omar Sosa.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the founders, the creative director of Apartmento, is a very exciting... I've not heard him speak in London before. And that's a brilliant example of it sort of crosses between what those some smaller independents are doing. It started off like that, but has transcended that to become quite a global success story in its own right.
Mm. It'll be interesting as well. I think also, I think the audience too. And I would imagine, I guess, that the audience that you're attracting to this... Is it a lot of industry people who you feel are, and I say industry people, maybe really sort of publishers who are managing the books who are in attendance, or would you say it's less from the business side and more from the creative side?
It's more, definitely more from the creative side so far. We're holding it at Central St. Martin's, and so we're looking to part of the arrangement of holding it there is that there'll be a lot of their design and fashion students will be attending. Mm. But then on the professional side, it's primarily creative, but we're already seeing the tickets now beginning to, as people look in their diary and get a bit more kind of aware of what's happening on Wednesday week, we're seeing it broaden out into the industry.
Mm. Lucia, it's just interesting listening to Jeremy talk about maybe the construct of something like Business Week, for example, this wonderful weekly and how it, in many ways, it's sort of reinvented what that type of title can be. You sat in a very luxurious position at a paper like the Financial Times and created this extraordinary magazine in the form of How to Spend It, certainly something which has brought in a lot of money for that brand, as we all know. What was the evolution like? And I just for people who probably reading a copy of it today. If you sort of look back, how was it regarded at the FT and how it came to life?
It was extremely painful, if I may say. my initial notion was that... I'm sorry if it sounds a little bit boastful, but my pages on the newspaper were really rather successful and couldn't therefore take all the ads that people wanted to put on them. And there was a limit to how many of those pages could grow within the pink bit of the Weekend FT. And so we started to think of another formula. And Colour Magazines was an obvious step. I mean, all sorts of people had done Colour Magazines. It was an obvious step. But I'm afraid the Financial Times at the time was very reluctant to spend a single penny on it. I could only ever do what I could pay for out of the advertising. And to begin with, it was done on the pink paper, just broadsheet, pink paper with ads. And then gradually it evolved. But I have to say, one got extraordinarily little support and no investment. I think the current editor has made a fantastic success of it. But the thing I'm proudest of, really, is a fighting for the size of it. Everybody wanted to make it smaller, and I insisted on that big size, very largely because I thought we could make things look so much more beautiful. And, of course, it gave a very much more beautiful platform for ads. You know, they just look wonderful.
Yeah, but just before we go to break, doesn't it surprise you, I guess, to both of you? I mean, how much people still want to shrink things down to almost bring it to a level of how we sort of view things on a digital screen. But of course, if you are a major watch company, nothing better than to see your ad on a fantastic bit of glossy stock.
Well, it's quite interesting because I was just saying that today the Telegraph has launched what is clearly an attempt to take some of How to Spend Its Ground. Mm. I don't know if you've seen it.
Not yet.
They've launched a magazine called Luxury, and they have also kept the same size. They've got a different font. Mm. I have to say, I think that the front cover is deeply disappointing. It looks rather like an ad. And I just think you want something so luscious that you really want to take it home and buy it. Mm. And I really don't like the cover, but it looks pretty accomplished inside.
Mm. Well, we can.
And it's very fat and full of a lot of ads.
And they've actually invested in a slightly heavier stock than the FT has as well. It seems to be a slightly thicker cover.
Yes.
But as you said, the cover image, I can't tell if that's a piece of art or if it's a bangle. Nevertheless, we can dissect that a little bit later. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Short break. We are off to Miami after this.
Monocle's latest collaboration with Comme des Garçons results in a light, energizing and refreshing unisex perfume, titled and inspired by Japanese cedar Sugi. It has top notes of Mediterranean cypress and pepper from Madagascar, a hint of iris from Florence and cedar from Virginia. With a bottle designed by Monocle's own designers, Scent 3, Sugi, is the long-awaited addition to Monocle's fragrance collection. Available in all 5 Monocle shops, Dover Street Market in London and Tokyo, and of course, online at monocle.com/shop.
And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Now, as part of our newspaper industry double bill this week, we go south. Latin America's journalism dynasties have been influential in the region for more than a century. There's the Miro Quesadas family in Peru, the Edwards in Chile, and the Santoses in Colombia. Until the newspaper was sold in 2012 to a local businessman, El Tiempo was run by the Santos family. And one of the brothers, Luis Fernando Santos, worked in the company for 40 years as president. Our own America's bureau chief, Santiago Rodriguez Sarditi, caught up with him in Miami during a festival of media and talked about his career and how the print versus digital debate has affected the delivery and content of news in Colombia.
I was born to a family of newspaper people. My father worked in the newspaper, my uncle. And when I graduated from high school, because I used to like to write a lot when I was in high school, I told my parents that I wanted to study journalism, and they told me, don't even think about it. That you learn about that here, getting yourself ink all over the place, and don't study that. But I persisted, and at that time, no internet, no way to find out. I went to a library that had all the books of universities and ended up at the University of Kansas. very, very good journalism school and a fantastic experience, because it was another way of looking at not only journalism and you know, writing headlines and editing and cropping pictures and the aspect of the day-to-day of journalism. What I most learned during those 4 years was about the business of newspapers, because I had the good chance of having internships in the Kansas City Star and the Miami Herald and in other newspapers. And there I saw that it was a demanding, sophisticated business, which was not the way it was seen locally at in Colombia or at our newspaper.
And how did you apply what you learned in Kansas to your everyday work in Colombia? And how did the country and the readers react to those new ideas?
Well, there were several facets of that. One of them, for example, in the newsroom was, at that time, every journalist had their own small little office, very little communication among them. And insisting I did this with one of my brothers who was working there, of opening it up and having a copy desk, which they didn't have one, and getting a much more integrated newsroom, print only at the time. Then I led all the technical change from lead linotypes to computers, which was very interesting, a lot of opportunities, and sending the newspaper by satellite to other printing plants, and a total change in the dynamic of the newspaper. I got all the different sections talking to each other. At that time, the people in the press room never talked with the people in the newsroom. They didn't even know them. They were like two different companies. Advertising people were another planet. And I started integrating them, and it was very successful.
How do you see the current state of journalism in Colombia and in Latin America? What are we doing well? What are we lacking in comparison to other countries around the world?
It changes from country to country, but I've seen a little bit of a decline in the quality of reporting and the management of content. I think most companies are a little bit too stressed out with the digital threats. The companies that are traditional companies, television, radio, and print, all they're doing is trying to get ratings, and they sacrifice quality a little bit because of that. So I think we're going through not a very good period. On the other hand, I think that it's going to be a period where the ones who stick to quality, invest in the newsroom, know that credibility, quality is part of the future of their brand and their business, they're going to do quite well, because people are starting to get tired of lower quality of news.
What type of magazine or newspaper do you think readers in Latin America are asking for? What do they need?
I think not only Latin America, but everywhere, there's been an adjustment of what are my sources of information. Obviously, the older people, when I say older, 40 and plus, still are very dependent on print. And the newcomers are more on digital, but they have a bigger appetite for news. So the businesses who are in news have a great opportunity, even though we all know they have big threats, because nobody's paying for news. Like everywhere else, it's going to be an accommodation of which of the platforms are the most preponderant at different times of the age of the users.
And finally, the inevitable question, will print die? Will digital take over?
No, I've been, since I started studying journalism, that was the first thing that was put in front of me, and Marshall McLuhan saying in this 1967 that print wouldn't exist in 10 more years. That was a subject when TV came, when radio came, then Bill Gates, and then Turner, and today everybody. It's just adjusting and accommodating. Many people still think there's nothing more comfortable, at ease, and faster to navigate than newspaper. Other people think this is terrible that they cut down a tree to put a news on paper. I'm of the position that it will survive, without a doubt, but it's just accommodating. There won't be those large circulation newspapers that we saw before. There will be fewer newspapers, but there will be newspapers.
And that was Luis Fernando Santos talking to fellow Colombian and Monocle's very own America's Bureau Chief Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi. Lucia, it was interesting just hearing him say that advertising was on another planet, within this particular media house. But even though there's all of this discussion about integration and maybe this is a time when there has to be less of a division between church and state. Do you still think when you talk to colleagues in the newspaper world, and of course, certainly what you launched with the FT and where you are at the moment, do you still think that advertising and editorial are really living in separate worlds, and there's maybe not enough coming together at a time when, of course, many elements in print are under threat?
Well, I think that it's a very uncertain world. I mean, I wish I knew the answers. I don't think anybody knows the answers. I mean, I'm a bit with the nice gentleman from Colombia. I feel that there will be a place. I think there's always a place for beauty in one's life. And there are magazines that are able to distinguish themselves by being a joy to read, a joy to hold. I think there will always be a place for that. And as we discussed earlier, a beautiful Patek Philippe or Audemars Piguet, it really doesn't look the same online when you see a little gadget like that. Whereas when you see it beautifully photographed in a magazine and a proper explanation of why it costs 50,000 and the craft behind it, then you see that there really is no, in my view, no substitute for paper.
I was in Geneva last week, and it was interesting talking to one of the big competitors to those watch companies that you mentioned, and they've just mounted a massive print campaign, but then they also did something quite large digitally as well, and on television with the same theme and this and really sort of featuring the same individuals. But they said, collectively the company just said, we've spent all this money on television, all this money on digital, but they said really where they felt there was cut through was still in print. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me actually at all. I mean, I'm very happy to hear it, but it's sort of a gut feeling that I have too. And I remember speaking to the editor, funnily enough, of the FT. I did an interview with him the other day, and I asked him how optimistic he was about the future of newspapers, and he was extraordinarily optimistic. I mean, what he said is what you have to think of is things like news as being news with multi-channels. And I guess that the makers of watches and handbags and everything else is having to think of multi-channels and tailoring, I suppose, their particular ads for the particular medium.
Jeremy, when you look at magazines, though, I'm surprised. I looked at the Economist last week, or it could have been 2 weeks ago. How much of that magazine now, it really seems that it's being bankrolled by luxury goods. It's not the oil companies. It's not even the financial institutions. It's an outside back cover by Louis Vuitton. It's an opening spread probably by Cartier, if I recall. And as you go through it, there's men's suiting companies and everything. Do you think that this, when it comes to print, is it partly that the luxury goods industry sort of understands the value still of being on paper, while maybe some of these, not more traditional, but certainly more traditional players in the really sort of the hardcore news space are maybe they have a few question marks, and they're in this digital debate themselves. How much should they be online on the news services versus do they see a value on paper anymore?
Well, I think as Lucia says, there's beautiful objects look better on paper. I think... Yes, if we kind of analyse and research everything down to its purest, most functional sense, everything can go on online. It can happen spontaneously, but you strip out all beauty and you strip out four of the senses in the process in terms of touch and smell. I think papers. I'm so bored with this discussion about the end of print. It's so over. It's a multi-channel world. We all use our iPhones or our tablets as well as our laptops, and we enjoy print when it's appropriate. And I think it's very interesting. I mean, clearly,
you should go into many media companies though, and have that discussion, which is amazing. And I'm not just talking about the publishers, but also the media buying agencies, where you have a generation of 24-year-olds who might have been weaned on these, who do believe that all of this fine pulp around us is dead, and they're calling the shots.
I'm very aware of that. on their side, I think it's dead. On the other side of the fence, from where I am, I'm constantly receiving new magazines, new ideas from other 24-year-olds who want to make magazines.
And when you speak to these young publishers and editors, and I guess going back to what I was asking Lucia about, you know, advertising beyond on another planet, you know, when we talk about this surge of all of these, you know, new self-published titles, do you think there's also a different awareness, there's a different type of entrepreneurialism with these types of editors today as opposed to days of yore?
Absolutely. And I think there is, you know, the church versus state argument is much less of an issue for these people. They have a more entrepreneurial sense, but they're still realistic about the value of journalism and the importance of at least a perception of difference, separation between the two. But they're much more accepting of the idea that you have to be commercial.
Mm. Speaking of all things beautiful on paper, why don't we start with you?
Okay.
I see you reaching for a glass of water, but why don't you reach for one of the titles first? What do you want to talk about first?
I'd like to start with a very small magazine right at the opposite end of some of the bigger things we've been talking about. It's from New York. It's published by an individual, Alana Schlenker, in Brooklyn, who makes gratuitous type, and this is the third issue. They've been named issue A, issue B, so this is issue C, and it's about design.
Mm-hmm.
It's limited. It's a 1,000 print run, so it can afford to be very special in a way that other things can't be. And it describes itself as a pamphlet of typographic smut. so it's making the most of the geekiness of the type and design world. In a very enjoyable way. And it does something very different. I think there's a lot of design magazines around still who do their job very well, and they tend to be expressed and presented in a typically kind of modernist style of presentation that reflects a lot of the content, whereas this has got much more character and flamboyance to it.
It has a wonderful die-cut C on the front cover, which... maybe it's probably not the best letter to die cut because I could see this shredding very easily because obviously this is a title that you want to hold on to. Lucia, how often are you sort of delving into, let's say, the more obscure and emerging end of the newsstand, and do these types of titles have a place on your coffee table?
Well, sadly, I don't. I can see that there's a whole world out there that I'm really not explored. I rather love this kind of thing. I mean, there's one magazine that I do, that is a bit obscure, which I do happen to absolutely love, which is called Selvage. I didn't bring one in, but it explores mostly the world of textiles. And what I love about it is that it's very niche by people who absolutely love their subject and really know it.
Mm-hmm.
And they always uncover very... what I call really understated niche looks.
Mm.
You know, they might do the textiles of that wonderful Indian designer, Asha Arabai, and I absolutely love that. I mean, I think this is absolutely wonderful. The trouble is that I'm so busy keeping up with my end of things that it's hard to really to dip into
these
others. But I do feel that there are, made by people who are really passionate. And I think that's what, when one discusses really beautiful, lovely, interesting things, it's always when there's a passion behind it.
Mm. Absolutely. And the challenge is, does that passion come through to people that maybe aren't interested necessarily in that subject? And I think that's, if that comes across to the stranger to the subject, then you've won.
Mm. Yes, I'm not a typographical expert, but I can see that I would really enjoy looking through that.
Now, you say you're not a typographical expert, but I wonder how much were your sleeves sort of rolled up, you know, doing your original Pink Pages, then launching How to Spend It, Lucia, and really sort of, you know, being in the trenches, you know, with the art director and team as that was all coming together.
Well, I always wished I'd known far more about it. I think it would have been a really, really great help. I was really came into journalism as a wordsmith. That's really where I grew up. And you know that newspapers don't. I mean, maybe now they train people better. I mean, I was just thrown in. Nobody ever taught me. Nobody ever showed me. So I had to kind of learn on the job.
Mm.
And I think I was extremely lucky because when I joined the FT, it was really the parish newspaper of the city. It was small, and I kind of grew with it.
I think that in previous ages, there's also been a huge kind of union-orientated separation between the production and journalism itself, wasn't there? Whereas I think things are a bit tighter now.
Absolutely. I can remember my first day on the Sunday Telegraph going into the printing room and touching a bit of type.
Mm.
And the guy came over to me, and I couldn't believe it. He said, "I will stop the presses."
Yeah.
We're going to just take a very, very short break. When we come back, though, we are going to head to the heart of Middle Europe. We're heading to Austria. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Well, now we swap the Andes for the Alps and land in Vienna. We've heard the story the world over and in Austria, too. Traditional print advertising is in decline, and newspapers and magazines are trying to gauge what and where the right platform is. The Middle European country's only privately owned daily, Der Standard, recently merged its print and online editions in a move that is already being replicated by other Austrian papers. Our contributor in Vienna, Alexei Korolev, has talked to Der Standard's editors.
Der Standard's offices are bustling with activity. It's been 3 months since the paper's print and online editions merged, but there's still some confusion.
We have a lot of worries on both sides. We have the worries on the print side and on the online side, and both are, they think that their product will lose quality when you merge.
Rainer Schuller is Der Standard's deputy editor-in-chief. With round about 200 staff members, Der Standard is Austria's biggest daily broadsheet. Schuller says that while there was some financial pressure on the print edition, it wasn't the primary reason for the merger.
One of the reasons is also the future of journalism. The future of journalism will be much more online than now. You get more and more readers on the online side, and you lose more and more readers on the print side.
Other Austrian papers are already trying to emulate Der Standard's cross-media model, Schuller says.
In fact, all the others are doing the same now. Der Standard has the biggest online department in Austria on daily paper, and therefore it's the more challenging thing in comparison to our competitors.
Even though the move was expected, it caught some of Der Standard's staff off guard, says Josef Kirchengast, a senior editor on the paper's foreign affairs desk.
Many, many, many people in editorial staff, they expected it actually quite earlier. And it came somehow as a surprise. And it created quite a deal of anxiety and uncertainty.
But Kirchengast is optimistic.
But meanwhile, things, I think, are mainly on track. There are lots of conferences and meetings. It's a kind of a learning by doing, I would say, yes.
He says their standard editors now have to address some specific issues.
We will have to redefine the philosophy of the print edition in general, and especially as for the weekend edition. And there's an ongoing discussion how to deal with news, what kind of news should have priority online, and what are the main assets of the print edition.
Another problem is trying to bring home to Der Standard's employees that print and online content are of equal value, Rainer Schuller says.
I hope that in the future an editorial staff working for the Standard and all the journalists working for the Standard will not distinguish between print or online, and they will not care about whether their story will be printed or the story will be in the internet.
In fact, the new attitude is already very much in evidence, Schuller says.
There will be a change in the general use of media. My son is growing up with my iPhone, and he will not make it a difference between a printed article and an online article. Our goal must be that we must find ways to do better journalism, and it's not important where it happens.
For Monocle in Vienna, I am Alexei Korolev.
Yes, as we were saying a little bit earlier, nothing sort of beats also the good old newsstands of Middle Europa as well. Lucia, just before we went to that, though, you were motioning to a magazine that you wanted to chat about. And I'm wondering, of the stack that you brought in, what did you want to discuss today?
Well, it's just that two of the glossy magazines have had changes of editors fairly recently. One is Harper's Bazaar, where Justine Picardy has taken over from Lucy Yeomans, who's gone to Net-a-Porter.
And this is in the, we're talking about the UK edition here, yes.
This is the UK edition, yes. Absolutely. And equally, Condé Nast Traveller, where Melinda Stevens is the new editor. And so I was quite interested to see what they would do with them, always keeping an eye on my competitors. I have to say that what I do like about the new Harper's is that they seem to be doing what Vogue used to do so well many, many years ago, which is to really give us a cultural heft with our fashion, because the two are so always interlinked. It always seemed to me, I mean, Vogue and Harper's in the old days used to commission the best photographers, fantastic artists, and they had serious cultural pieces. And I think that that is what Justine Picardy seems to be trying to do with Bazaar.
Jeremy, how much do you look at the traditional part of the newsstand? Because, you know, and to maybe use the horrible word, as Lucia was saying, the zeitgeist, you know, you're at the vanguard of always sort of picking up, you know, all that is new. But is there almost a secret pleasure that there's also, the more established end of the newsstand that you like as well?
There is, absolutely. I mean, the one magazine that I actively subscribe to rather than hope I get sent is The New Yorker. Which, I mean, that's an easy option, not a surprise. But Harper's, is an interesting project, very much for the reasons you're describing. I think it's got a fantastic history behind it. And I think I met with Justine recently. In fact, she's going to be at the conference. But they're actively looking back at their huge archive. And I think in its competition with Vogue, I think we know a lot about Vogue and the history and the great famous contributors they've had over the years. We know less about Harper's, and actually they've got a similar history. Mm. They've got a great record of commissioning the first short stories from great authors, et cetera, et cetera. And I think they're trying to revisit some of that.
And Hearst seemed very aggressive at the moment. I was in Paris the other day. I met a former colleague, and she's been picked up as one of the editors because they're launching a French edition of Harper's Bazaar as well. And I mean, it's one thing that we can sort of look at the state of the French economy, but you've just seen the launch of a French edition of Vanity Fair now. The soft porn title Louis has come back on the newsstand as well. And I brought this, and I just maybe wanted to get both of your views. They've just launched Elle Man. So here you have... a very significant French group, and of course, Elle being a major global brand, and now they venture into doing a men's edition. And I've heard already they're doing a Chinese edition of it as well for men. Just first impressions, Jeremy.
First impressions. It seems like there's no meat in it. I'm flicking through, and it's very hard to find anything of any great length or depth. That's the very first impression.
But, lasting impressions as well. I'm wondering, Lucia, when you look through it, and of course, just given your glossy background, I find it doesn't sort of add up. But I think when you really think of, you know, what not just French Elle, but I think, I think many of the very, very good editions of Elle do. Lucia?
Well, I've always felt there was a gap for something for men myself, because, I mean, I have a son who's passionately interested in, when I say passionately, that's probably the wrong word. He's interested in what he would like to wear and needs a bit of help because he doesn't look like George Clooney, although he's divine. He needs a bit of help. And so few people seem to address people like him. And I just think there is such a niche for that. You know, he's never going to wear shorts to the city or dress in, combinations of pink and yellow, which you so often see. And this looks to me as if this might be a more normal magazine. But I agree, it's quite hard to know exactly where one should stop to read. One sort of flicks through and thinks, quite, what is that about? I mean, it has enough of the edgy to make it interesting. But I really feel that there is a real, real gap for helping guys who have an interest and quite broad interest. I don't know who addresses them, and I think that there is a gap.
I think even some of the more traditional titles that are out there on the newsstand, you often think that they just get carried away with the stylist and photographer, and you wonder where is sort of the value in terms of what people might purchase. Are you attracted to men's magazines as I guess as tools of service in a way, Jeremy?
No.
No.
Simply not. I mean, they don't relate to me. I think they tend to be, the men's market is much smaller and tighter, and they're much more kind of ad vehicles, and they survive on that.
But Luci, aren't you surprised? We were talking about, I should probably look for this Telegraph supplement again. But that the newspapers that, you know, whether it's the FT or the Times, don't do a better job themselves of really trying to talk to men in a sensible way, because they've got that captive audience.
I totally agree with you, and I think actually the How to Spend It has now addressed the matter. They have had a very good menswear writer, I think, Tom Stubbs, and I think they realised that there was a sort of gap there. But I agree. I mean, if you look at the ad figures, I'm told that particularly in the grooming area, it's the fastest growing area. I mean, it's no. I mean, Bernard Arnault always has his fingers on the pulse, and he has charged his son with turning Belluti into a completely men's lifestyle brand. And I think there really is a big market for looks, but wearable menswear.
I'm just looking through the Telegraph, and we're talking about the Telegraph's new luxury.
There's very magazine. Little for men there.
Not very much. Yeah, there's the odd little column, lots of watches, and then just a lot of one sort of shot of as you were saying, something you would not be wearing to the city. Very chunky boots, chunky jumpers, and a bag that you'd probably climb up the Eiger with. So definitely not something for your son. We're going to take a very very short break. When we come back, we're going to be looking at a title a little closer at home here in London. Now we're going to stay a little bit closer to Midori House and hit the streets and squares of London with an unlikely magazine partnership, a couple of bikers who had a dream in print. The diminutive, almost delicate Essis magazine was out earlier this year, and with its journal entries and striking photography is not what you might expect when you think of a magazine for motorcycle enthusiasts. A nod to motorhead nostalgia maybe, but with its contemporary feet or wheels most definitely on the ground, Essis is a new take on a very cliched pastime. Earlier, our David Pleasant met with the magazine's editor, David Burton, and creative director, John Butterworth.
We were chatting for a good year before we really started kind of putting the magazine together about creating a motorcycle magazine that was different from everything else that was on the shelves, I guess. We wanted to create something that was much more kind of human interest story, so real people focused. And we kicked it around for a good 12 months, didn't we? Before we actually kind of started working on it. And we had an idea for, we were changing the format. We were going to do it as a newspaper at one point, and then slightly smaller. And it was kind of off and on because we've both got day jobs within the industry as well. This was very much a passion, so it was kind of evenings and weekends, and we'd catch up and talk about it, get really excited, and then be busy at work and so forget about it for a while. And then the magazine came out about May this year, so sort of probably kind of 12 months before that. So last summer we kind of started putting it together. We kind of figured out what we wanted to do with it, felt feature ideas, we kicked loads of feature ideas around, but kind of got to a stage where the sort of things that we both wanted to do that interested us, that we thought was missing maybe from kind of the wider motorcycle press.
And what kind of, if you kind of paint the landscape of what the motorcycle press might be like, what are the kind of rivals? What were you trying to kind of pitch yourselves against or do something different in a way? What's out there?
I don't think we have any rivals, and it was never about that. I think kind of for us, we love kind of telling stories and kind of people stories, human interest stories. When we were talking about what S's would be, we kind of felt that if anything was missing from the motorbike press, do group tests and product reviews and all that stuff fantastically well, obviously they do. And it just kind of felt that there's something lacking from the bike press that we were buying and reading, which was kind of real people stories. So the people behind the bikes, whether they kind of ride them or tweak them
or design them. Are you an avid motorcyclist? Are you a biker yourself?
I haven't got a motorbike myself. I'm a cyclist, but not a motorcyclist. Okay. But I've been around motorbikes for a very long time because of my father. He collects old World War II motorbikes, so I've seen motorbikes forever. And I've just really followed the culture with him. You go off to the rallies and things like that. So I don't think not riding has been a kind of a problem really for myself.
And it's kind of influenced the design. If we talk maybe a little bit about how the magazine feels and looks, it's quite a small format that you've gone for. Tell us a bit about what options, what design choices you made.
One, we wanted to create a look that was obviously different from the shelf titles as well. I think kind of something that kind of really felt different. So the format was smaller, it's on uncoated stock. A lot of the features are design-wise are broken up into kind of blocks of text and then blocks of pictures rather than kind of, I guess, like a normal way of producing a magazine feature where you kind of mix the two. So there's kind of that aspect of it, of making it look and feel different, almost like a journal, I guess, rather than a magazine, setting it aside from kind of its, I don't think we have any competitors, but setting it aside from other magazines.
The photographers that we've used on the magazine mainly are photographers that we've worked with for a very long time, and we thought, let's get everyone we know involved with it from an early starting point, so such as Andy Earle, who used to help us on other projects, and Duncan Kendall, great photographers, and we've worked with them for such a long time, we can mould them and use them in a way that we need. And I think that shows through the photography throughout the entire magazine.
Well, in terms of our readership, I mean, it's quite hard to figure out kind of who, what bikes they ride at the moment. I mean, the vast majority of our sales are through our website and through PayPal. And we have kind of, you know, independent news agents and some bike garages and outlets that are selling it for us. I think, bizarrely, we never had kind of one, and I don't know whether this will live or die because of this, but we never had kind of one biker in mind, I suppose. Primarily, the magazine is kind of for... We wanted the things that are in the features that are in the magazine are features that we want to put in that kind of excite us. And I think hopefully it will be bikers who are interested in great storytelling, who are interested in people, who are interested in design, who aren't interested in just the kind of style of bike, type of bike that they actually ride. I think, you know, kind of the interesting thing about Speedway is that Speedway is a very kind of niche, closed community, and not a lot of Speedway fans actually ride motorcycles either. So it's kind of, it's a massive learning curve for us that there are all sorts of different kind of people and bikers out there. And we never kind of thought that we'd just hit kind of the sports bike market or the tourer market or guys that love to race or to go and watch racing. And the idea was to kind of almost like bring together everybody who likes all sorts of different aspects of motorcycling and kind of give them something different that they haven't had before. I remember reading in a motorbike magazine about a group test feature that this publication had done. I don't remember what the bikes were or what the publication was, but I just remember thinking that I was reading this 8-page feature about a road test editor who could ride a bike much better than I could, who's testing a bike that I'll never be able to afford on a track that I'll never go to. And it just kind of didn't, on the one, I was kind of interested about reading it, but there was just this massive barrier to reading about someone else having fun. So I think kind of the idea behind it all is to kind of tell these kind of great people stories of people who were into this community. So in terms of who the reader is, I haven't got a clue.
I was going to say that the title was amazing. We, as we say, I was sat with David and we were thinking about so many ideas for names of the magazine, and it was an email, wasn't it? You emailed me, or was it a phone call? And David said, what about S's? And I was thinking, S's, what the hell is S's? And then David explained that it was the bends in the road and this is how they talk about it on the track. And as soon as I heard that name, I knew it was spot on. I knew it was correct. That's when the magazine really started to come to life and really feel like it was a real object.
And we are back. Lucia, before we went away, we were you were talking about Condé Nast Traveler. We talked a little bit about Harper's, but you know, this was, you know, again a title which, you know, hit you know, UK newsstands. Of course, grew out of the US edition. And I just wanted to know when Sarah was there before, and I guess sort of what's happened, sort of evolution wise, because not much has changed cover wise. It's got, you know, it's got that, you know, iconic, the double L Traveler, as opposed to the single L US Traveler edition. What do you make of the transformation? I guess it's probably been over, I guess, around a year now, isn't it?
I think it's about a year. Well, I suppose the main thing I notice is that Melinda herself has three children, I think it is, and she's making it much more family friendly. I think there's always been a big debate as to whether children make a magazine look rather cute and less sophisticated. Mm. But she's made.
Well, I think there's a bigger issue also. You know, a lot of people think, you know, should children be traveling to premium places as well, which I think is always a hot topic.
Yeah, exactly. Lovely if they're your children, not so nice if they're somebody else's. So she's made it much more family friendly, and she has made it, I think, very lively. She still covers the hot destinations and does quite a lot of trend stories, but I think it is extremely lively. I think it's very difficult to reinvent a magazine that it was clearly successful.
Mm. Do you think it was a commercial push, or it was the passion of the editor, though, to, as you said, make it more family friendly? Because I wonder how much more advertising would you pull in. I mean, they're clearly not looking for package tours and things like that. They also want the luxury goods in there. So you think that's her personality as an editor coming through?
I think it's partly that, but I also think the demographics of money have changed enormously, and that a lot of these young hedge fund guys and internet entrepreneurs make their money much younger, and they want to travel with their kids. And a lot of these very, very busy families, you know, two people working, a high-flying lawyer and a hedge funder, they don't see enough of their kids, and they certainly don't want to leave them behind when
Absolutely.
They travel.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So I think the demographics have changed and made that very important. I mean, it's quite interesting that in Safari Land, for instance, which I sort of follow and write about quite a bit, it's one of the biggest changes. I interviewed Dave Varty, who owns Londolozi, one of the iconic safari destinations in South Africa, and he said to me, you know, 15, 20 years ago, Safari Land was no-go area for children. Now he said it would be financial suicide not to make special arrangements for children.
Mm.
So it's one of the biggest growth areas. Another interesting growth area is the multi-generational holiday. You know, I mean, we do it now. We grandparents, if we want to see our kids, we pay for them to come on holiday. And, you know, we've taken grandchildren to South Africa and to Africa. And apparently this is, it's instead of having sort of standing around in Claridge's with canapes, they'd rather go and have an adventure somewhere.
And do you think that's something which is more, you know, arrived on Anglo-Saxon shores? Because I think if you look at Asian families, I think a lot of people I know in Hong Kong and Singapore, they vote, and Thailand as well, you know, Thai families, they always travel sort of multi-generationally. They, you know, they love going, you know, they love booking a Crystal Cruise and taking sort of, you know, 16 people and staff with them. And I'm wondering if that is something which is just really pulling up on European shores right now, maybe.
I think it is a fairly new thing in Europe, particularly, as I say, it's a noticeable trend in Africa, where mostly safari goers were older people who went on their own, and they didn't want other people's children having tantrums in the Land Rover. you know, whereas now, I think it is a different trend.
Mm.
And I think, you know, that there is more money. I mean, when I first came to England, it was still, it was a long time ago, you know, it was still in the throes of post-depression. I mean, I can remember having to go skiing and we could only take £50. That was all. We had to hide money in our socks.
I wanted to ask you, we talk about the title Anorak, which of course is focused on kids. Are you seeing more titles or anything else that's come along as well to maybe sort of, you know, fill this gap? And as you're saying, if you've got, you know, premium consumers, you know, who like great titles, are they looking for similar things for the kids? And is anyone responding?
There are other titles. There's The Loop, which is in trying to do something perhaps slightly more deliberately educational and work with schools. But there's not. I've not really seen anything very specific launch into that. But I think it's one of those things where it's, you're sort of seeing it in Traveller and other magazines more naturally. It's just part of life that comes into it rather than being separated.
Mm. And you don't, Lucia, do you find that your editors, where you're contributing, are asking you to dip into that a little bit more or not so much?
Well, funnily enough, not very much at How to Spend It. I think that Gillian has a very focused idea of what she wants. And she wants a very, very sophisticated magazine. And as she says, the problem with children is they tend to look cute, you know, whereas what you want is high-level sophistication.
Mm.
But Traveller, it's a different magazine, you know. It is about travelling, and that is a big... It's a big change in the demographics of travellers.
Mm. We are going to have to leave it there. Lucia van der Post, always very good to see you. Thank you very much for coming on the programme today. And also Jeremy Lessig, just one quick plug for the conference. Date is?
October 16th, Wednesday week.
Okay, and a few tickets left.
Oh, yeah, there are some tickets left online, yes.
Excellent. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and Amy Fitzgibbon. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And behind the glass, managing the desk and the sound, our studio manager, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries for today's programme, do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And remember, of course, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. And you can always listen again on iTunes as well. The Review with Gillian Tobias and Chloe Potter is coming up at midday. News is next.